Hi, I'm Chris Irwin. Welcome to The Come Up, a podcast that interviews entrepreneurs and leaders.
This is a common theme in my career, which some people say like ignorance is bliss, right? I like to say ignorance is rich. And what I mean by that is like every single thing I've done, I don't know anything about. And when you know too much about something, you become institutionalized with fear. So because I knew nothing about putting on an event or a trade show, I wasn't scared of it. I just kind of did it and didn't think about it that much. And it just kind of happened. And it was luckily successful.
This week's episode features Aaron Levant, the CEO and founder of Network. Aaron is one of the most exciting builders at the intersection of fashion, culture, events, and media. And he started super early. At just 9 years old, Aaron used picture cutouts and a Xerox machine to launch a car mag, and it was profitable. He sold copies to friends at school and advertising to neighbors. Then, in his early 20s, Aaron launched a fashion trade show, which he sold to a major exhibition company. There, Aaron then masterminded the biggest experiential businesses of the past decade, like when he pitched Mark Echo on ComplexCon. But Aaron's not just a builder. He's also operationally defiant. He doesn't follow norms and believes that lack of experience is a major advantage in launching startups. This mindset fuels Aaron's current business, Network, which powers shopping at the speed of culture. Network is hands down one of the hottest players in content and commerce, and has attracted backers like Jimmy Iovine, LeBron, Drake, Foot Locker, and many more. Now, Aaron's story is remarkable, but his character is more impressive. He's unconventional, uplifting, and so grounded. That, plus hearing him talk about his future plans for Network and how he thinks about his career in thirds, makes for a must listen. All right, let's get into it. Tell me a little bit about growing up in the Valley, your household, and what your parents were like.
You know, Valley here in Santa Fernando Valley in LA is a nice place to grow up. You know, a little bit of suburbia, very, very close to LA. My parents were amazing people who were very kind of creatively inclined. My dad was in the entertainment business and spent a long time as a writer, television shows and things like that. So, you know, I'd say I grew up in a pretty creative household. My mom actually had like a little independent clothing label in the 80s. So, you know, I had some adjacency to the apparel business that I probably didn't even realize until years later. But, you know, like my mom was always involved in that. And yeah, my parents were just kind of like very into pop art, into pop culture. And my dad's a huge toy collector. He has 50,000 toys.
Wow.
So, you know, this kind of like affinity for pop culture is something I've been kind of growing up around my whole life.
Between your father's toy collection and then also being a writer and an entertainment and your mother in commerce, the whole new shoppable entertainment starting to get where it comes from pretty early for you. And when you were growing up, did you think like, oh yeah, I want to go into Hollywood. I want to be like my dad, or I want to do what my mom does. Was that going through your mind at all?
No, never. I mean, I had no interest in doing anything my dad did. I would say like most people probably I want to do the opposite of what they did. So I never ended up, you know, even though maybe what I'm doing has some connection in the entertainment industry now, like, you know, I was always going the other way. I would say I never met him, but my mom's father, my maternal grandfather, who I never met, was very entrepreneurial. And I felt like I've always had something ingrained in me to be entrepreneurial, which different than what my dad did and being interested in business, where my dad has no interest in business whatsoever. He almost despises it to a certain extent. So I would say I kind of rebelled against anything my parents did and wanted to do my own thing for whatever reason.
What type of businesses was your grandfather building back in the day?
He was in real estate, which is something I didn't get involved in either. And again, I hear this all by way of my mom and my grandmother, but he was just very entrepreneurial from a young age, always trying stuff. Apparently a very, very smart guy. So I try to think that's where I get some of my smarts from, because my dad is just not a business inclined guy. He's all about being creative.
I think you need both sides of the brain for what you're building right now. So it makes sense.
Definitely.
Your entrepreneurial ambitions, my understanding is that they manifested pretty early. I think you put together like a car magazine at like 8 or 9 years old, right? And then you were selling that to some of your school friends?
I still am and was back then interested in cars. Sometime around maybe 9 or 10 years old, I had made a car magazine through just, you know, I guess what now would be a zine, just cutting up a bunch of other great images of cars from books and going to Kinko's, or what was Kinko's, now FedEx now, and photocopying it. And I went to my next door neighbor who was an Arby's franchisee, and I sold him the back cover advertisement for, I don't even remember the price, but I just knew that my magazine wasn't going to be legit unless there was an ad on the back cover. So I guess I tout that as my very first business deal. And then I was selling that magazine at school and at camp. And for whatever reason, I just felt like I was always trying to do stuff like that, and did various random projects you know, as early on as that, all the way till I was 16 when I started doing some form of real business, I guess.
So it felt like in you pretty early on was that you just wanted to do stuff. You wanted to create, you wanted to try things out. Like there's just like this hustler inside, right?
Yeah. And I'm not even sure where it came from, but it just felt natural to me to try to create and try to monetize off those creations.
I've also heard you describe yourself as, you know, you go through your teen years as being, and I think this persists through today, oppositionally defiant. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's an actual word from the DSM, which I think is the book that they use in psychology to define what's wrong with you. It's like the dictionary of mental illnesses. So I think my mom pointed that out to me very early, which is I had a tendency to go against authority for good or bad reason, whether that's kicking the principal in the leg at the first day of preschool or doing any number of antics I did through my elementary and short high school years. I always felt the need to go the other direction, to go against the grain, against authority. And that was for some reason instilled in me. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact I just wasn't interested in being in school or being at camp or being anywhere there was authority figures trying to tell you what to do and how to dictate what you do with your time. And it was all very boring and kind of mundane for me.
And through that resistance early on, did that also attract like these types of friends and people that you wanted around you? Were you becoming a leader amongst the peer group saying like, I'm going to do things differently? And people were like, yeah, we're going to follow Aaron.
I would say yes or no. It depends. As I was younger, no. I think most of the kids I was hanging out with were pretty nice and I was the jerk in the group. And then as I got older, I probably attracted the wrong people. And then I spun out of that when I was like 18 years old. But no, I was just always doing wrong for myself, not necessarily with others or for others.
My understanding is that in 10th grade, you get kicked out of high school and then you start interning at GAT. Tell us, what was GAT and why was that interesting to you at the time?
Probably one of my second, third business adventures was I was really passionate about design and graffiti art and street art, you know, all through the 90s when I was a young teen and kind of being interested in that design and graffiti art and being interested in business. I was trying to figure out like, how do you make a living out of doing something you're passionate about?
Yeah.
And it dawned on me that all my favorite graffiti writers were working at GAT, particularly was the main place, and many other streetwear companies doing the t-shirt designs. And if you're a great graffiti artist, you're doing typography, it's a great transition into designing t-shirts and make a living for yourself. So I said,
yeah,
okay. And I started to develop an affinity for these companies. And randomly, a guy I grew up with, Tal Cooperman, introduced me to the owner of that company. And through meeting him a few times, you know, he ended up offering me an internship. And GAT was, you know, the definitive late 80s, mid 90s streetwear brand in LA. And it was such a great opportunity for me not only get close to this company and learn a trade that I was interested in, but also be around some of my favorite artists and learn from them and learn a craft, which at the time was graphic design for me for in the beginning of my career.
And going back to that moment where you're like, yeah, this is like the logical progression for how I get into my career. Or were you like a little bit shocked? It was like, whoa, I wasn't expecting to go down this path. But
I don't know if I was thinking in terms of a career. I was just so excited. I was such a fan, right? Like, yeah. I forget the days when I was legitimately just a fan of things.
Yeah.
And like, I was just so excited to be there. And I think it just kind of became a career, but I kind of stumbled into it. I was just genuinely happy to be there just to be a fly on the wall and be a fan. And then over a series of years of sticking around there, interning, having low-level positions, I turned around a few years later and I'd worked my way up to being a partner in the company. And then I was like, oh, well, I guess I turned this genuine interest or passion into a job.
What do you think helped you rise to become partner so quickly?
I think being willing to do anything. Yeah. Being willing to work for free in the beginning and then almost nothing, minimum wage for years after that. You know, I don't have any baggage. I'm like, oh, I was this important guy at this other company, so I won't take the trash out, right? I'll do literally anything. He's like, go drive to Orange County and pick up the sample. I'm like, great, I'll get there right now. Like, it's just like, whatever I could do, like, yeah. I was just waiting for someone to hand me the ball and I would just run with it. And I was so excited. I know there's like a famous like Biggie Smalls or Notorious B.I.G. line where he's talking about you got to treat every day like you're an intern, like it's your first day on the job, right? And I think I genuinely carried that through well beyond the time I was an intern. And I think that is what kind of propelled me up, that every time there was an opportunity, I raised my hand and ran at it enthusiastically where other people may not have.
Passion was there and it feels like you were just having fun. You're like, this is cool. This is where I want to be. Like, I'll work for whatever, but I'm doing this with cool people and I'm all in.
And at that time, most of my friends were still in high school and then eventually college. And I was well on my way to making my career, doing cool stuff, traveling around the country, you know, so it was exciting.
Fast forward a bit and let's talk about the Agenda Show, which was a trade show, I think, that you were a part of for almost around 15 years. So tell us about what that was and how that came to be.
Through my job at GAT, the founder of GAT was pretty much my first mentor. And I have a series of mentors in my life that really helped shape my career and my life. We would go with Louis to a lot of trade shows with his clothing brand. First, there was this big show in Las Vegas called the Magic Show, which is the biggest fashion trade show in the world at the time. It would get over 100,000 attendees. Wow. We'd go to the show in San Diego called the ASR Show, Action Sports Retail. These were B2B marketplaces in the fashion industry for different segments. And we would go as an attendee, as an exhibitor, if you will. We'd buy a booth and we'd sell our wares to the retailers traveling from all over the world. And in probably 2001, I had gone to New York to a really small show called To Be Confirmed, which was some guys from London. And they had just rented a loft in Soho. And instead of some huge, you know, show at the Javits Center or the Las Vegas Event Center, they just got a loft and put up some rolling racks and some tables and chairs. They had a cool DJ and a bar. And I said, this is pretty fucking cool. And I looked around, and I was thinking, like, how hard is this? Like, you rent an empty room and have some people throw up some rolling racks and you send out a postcard to invite some buyers and make a cool ambiance. I'm like, I like this. That was in the back of my mind. And at that time, me and Louis were actually throwing some parties in our warehouse in downtown LA called Agenda, Art, Music, Beer. And it was just something we did as like a fun thing and something to promote our clothing companies. And in 2002, in September, after having a bad experience at the ASR trade show, I said to Louis, I said, let's turn our Agenda parties into a fashion trade show as a competitor to the big action sports show in San Diego.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah. And in January 2003, a few months later, we rented a Thai restaurant across the street from the big show, invited 30 of our friends. We charged $500 a booth. We weren't really doing it to make money. We just thought we didn't have to pay the other guys $5,000 and we could provide a service to our friends and just do something kind of cool.
Yeah.
And it just kind of organically just kind of happened. But it was this small little B2B fashion trade show for independent brands that I did when I was 18, 19 years old.
So when you had that bad experience at ASR, you had the conversation, you're like, all right, we're going to launch the Agenda trade show. Were you excited? Were you nervous? Were you scared? Or was it like, no, I got this. Like, of course we're going to crush this. What was going through your head?
This is a common theme in my career, which some people say like ignorance is bliss, right? I like to say ignorance is rich. And what I mean by that is like every single thing I've done, I don't know anything about. And when you know too much about something, you become institutionalized with fear, or they say like paralysis by analysis, right? So because I knew nothing about putting on an event or a trade show, I wasn't scared of it. And I didn't know to be cocky or to be fearful or to have any expectation. I just kind of did it and didn't think about it that much. And it just kind of happened. And it was luckily successful. I'm sure it wasn't perfectly executed or anything in that way, but I just kind of run into things head first, run into a lot of problems, and don't really do too much research in the front end, because when you do, you seem to scare yourself or psych yourself out of doing whatever that said thing you're going to do. And I've done that a few times in my career where I don't know anything about it. And I've been more successful than sometimes people who do know something about it because they're institutionalized with fear.
Institutionalized with fear. I really like that. I just wrote down ignorance is rich. I think that's a fantastic, a fantastic phrase. All right. So at Agenda, it seems that you go through like a 8 to 10 year period of expansion and then realizing, hey, we have to move the venue from San Diego to Long Beach and then into Vegas. You're collaborating, but then you're also expanding and some new competition is coming. And there's a lot of details that we'll probably skip over here, but like along that journey, what are a couple moments that really stand out to you?
Three key things. One, I did the business completely independently, first with me and Louis, and then later with me and my cousin. And I still lived at my parents' house. And any business that people think about now in the world that we operate in, you know, they raise capital, they raise a seed round, they raise an A, they've got a burn rate. All these businesses have a finite amount of time that they're going to make it or not make it before they basically have to shut down operations or become profitable, right?
Yeah.
I didn't have that. I didn't even understand that as a concept. So I just kept going, even when it was going good and not going bad. And I carried that forward for so many years. So many times we weren't making any money because we didn't really have many employees. And because I lived at home with my parents until I was 23 or something, it allowed us to push past the point where most businesses would have given up and go, oh, this isn't, the margin isn't growing, our revenues aren't growing at the right rate. We had no analysis of the business. So it was an overwhelming theme that allowed us to kind of ever keep pushing forward, probably sillily at some points, to get to a point where we got actually really successful, to then where we almost had to shut down because the competition got so fierce. And in that moment in 2009, when our business was on the brink of going out of business, I think the defining moment for us was we finally pushed further enough and had this organic growth trajectory over many, many years, almost 6 years at that point, that I met a guy, Roger Wyatt and Paul Gomez from Nike and Hurley, and they offered us an opportunity to stop being the small show across the street from the big show. And this was the big judo business moment for us, which was they said, hey, how about you step out of this role you're in as being like the parasite, or I call it like the little sucker fish that swims along on the shark.
Yeah.
You know, we're always this little cool thing happening across the street from this big behemoth thing. And they said, why don't you come with us? You bring agenda to the US Open of Surfing, which is the biggest action sports consumer event in the world. And you should put your trade show in the middle of it. And there's 500,000 people that will be there.
Wow.
And that was a big departure for us. We were on the verge of going out of business with this one business model we knew, but we were making money finally.
Yeah.
And it was like this jump. It was like, we had to take this leap off the cliff, and it was either going to work or we were going to be dead in the water, but we're almost going to be dead in the water anyway. So we made this jump. And in 1 year of doing this, our business grew like 2,000%. And we put ASR out of business, which is a company that was been in business for 30 something years before that, owned by Nielsen Business Media. It was a huge company, established, respected company by all means. It was this moment where everything changed in our favor, and it was almost unprecedented. So I think that was, for me, like the real lesson there is like, to take those big risks to do something that literally was going to sink the company or save the company, and has inspired me to continue to do things like that throughout my career. But without that moment, I wouldn't be sitting here today. And I never would have done probably anything I've done after that. And probably agenda would have gotten down in flames as well.
I think it's like a takeaway that I'm definitely hearing. It just goes back to what you said again, like ignorance is rich, because you weren't looking at the business of saying like, what are the right metrics and all that, where if you were looking at through that lens or had different training up to that point, you would have shut it down. But you were building a brand, and you guys were just like, no, there's something here. There's something here. And sometimes like early stage businesses, they just need longevity, like stick around enough, because most just shut down within 3 to 5 years. But with longevity, other opportunities or other ways of thinking about what you have and how it can work. And this duo coming from Nike Hurley and saying, hey guys, here's another approach. And you're like, that's a great idea. Let's do it. And it just happens.
Yeah. That one moment literally defined everything for me professionally, financially. But if we didn't make it that far, I never would have had that chance. And even in that moment, it was risky. The best risk I ever take.
So it continues to grow. And then you eventually sell to Reed Exhibitions, I think Reed Pop in 2012. What was the reason for that?
Up until that point, from 2003, end of 2012, we sold in the end of December, like the day before Christmas, we signed the papers. The business was completely built independently. No loans from family, no, you know, lines of credit, no investors, no nothing. It was just me and my cousin. We owned 100% of the business. We financed the business. It was starting to get big. You know, we were kicking out, we were doing millions and millions of dollars in business, tens of millions, and it was making real EBITDA. But it was one of those things that like, it's risky. And it was our cash flow that was on the line, right? And we had built something that was fairly profitable and kind of weighed the risk of, we had just gotten out of the 2008 financial crisis. We saw a lot of bad stuff happen with that. I lived through seeing what happens during 9/11, right? There's all these things that come, and we're on this incredible ride. We're making so much money, and we kind of just did the math and said, hey, we can continue to do this on our own and carry the risk, and something could happen and we could lose all the value, or we could extrapolate the value now. And I think we did some quick back in the napkin math, and we figured we'd make more money and a lower tax rate than we could in 6 years if we sold the business today, if we kept operating it, right? And there's a lot of unknowns in the next 6 years, which I'm actually lucky, because the business did kind of downtrend in the next 6 years following that. And it was a calculated financial risk. And I had a bigger vision for the company than my cousin did. He was very risk averse. Also because we owned it independently and it was all of our money and capital on the line.
Yeah.
And we were just operating 4 shows when we sold. I took it after I sold it to about 30 shows. And he didn't want to go along with those things. So ultimately, when we sold, he exited the business and I went with Reed and built a whole portfolio of new products, consumer-facing products, conferences, video products, right? I had a much bigger vision than what we were doing in this kind of small mom and pop shop. So I think it really allowed us to take the financial risk off the table and set us up fairly well, but also allowed me to really chase the bigger vision that I had for the company.
Speaking of risk appetite, it seems that there's this constant leveling up or laddering up, where it's like, you know, I'm going to try something and then have a bigger win and then a bigger win and then next.
It's called gambling.
Got it.
So
the question for you is like, was your risk appetite growing where you felt like, hey, as an entrepreneur, as a business leader, I'm increasingly capable and I want to take bigger bets?
Absolutely. Like in every situation in my career, if I had the opportunity to spend 100, I'd spend 100. My cousin would say, spend 0. We'd end up spending 50. It was a good yin-yang balance, right? But at a certain point, when your business is hot and you have that moment, there's a reason they say strike while the iron's hot, right? Like every time we had that, that's when I say, let's go. Let's double down. Let's quadruple down. And he didn't want to go. And I think I've always been in favor of going. And I've lost a lot too. Don't get me wrong. Like I've had a plenty of horrible ideas, but like I'm a true believer, like you're not going to get anywhere. You're not going to build anything meaningful, anything big, by not doing that fairly often, by like putting it on the line and like rolling the dice on that. I'm a huge proponent of doing that as much as you can without being completely irresponsible, but you have to be slightly irresponsible.
And maybe we'll get into this as you describe how you are built the network executive team, but do you like having people around you that actually push you even harder and saying like, yeah, that's a good idea, but like, here's even bigger, Aaron? Or do you like people that kind of pull you back and then have like debate about what's the best path forward? How do you like to build leadership around you?
I think you got a mix of both, right? You've got some really good financial people that are helping me keep an eye on, you know, whatever that may be, the margin or the burn rate or things like that, to make sure that I'm not completely unchecked and doing completely frivolous things. But yeah, I mean, I think I love having people around me who are more aggressive, who have bigger goals, who are uninterested in doing small things, especially investors, right? I get that internally from staff, like my partner here, Moksha Fitzgibbons, who's the president at Network, constantly pushing. I thought I was aggressive. He's more aggressive than I am, constantly pushing the envelope, trying to push us to do bigger, faster, be more aspirational. And then our investors who have done, you know, all of them $1 billion businesses where they're like, yeah, that's cute what you're doing, but you know, this doesn't interest us unless it gets X big, right? And I love that kind of challenge because it makes me try to think bigger. Well, what may be relative success to me on the scale of my career to them is a blip on the radar. And it inspires me to want to do bigger and to make a bigger impact and create larger brand awareness and to, you know, take that bigger, whatever, Hail Mary pass, if you will. And I need those people around me constantly.
All right. So at Reed, you sell Agenda to them, but you continue to run the Agenda trade show. But then you're also responsible for, I think you launch 30 different events while you're there, including ComplexCon. I mean, I know that you're always a dabbler in doing different things, but like it seems that you were all in on Agenda. And now you're like, no, now you got a lot of different babies and children to take care of. How was that transition?
Yeah. I mean, look, I had never finished high school, never went to college. Yeah. Getting to Reed was an amazing opportunity for me because I worked inside a publicly traded company at a very senior level. It was like going to college, really learning to work in a structure, but also to them, they are a $7 billion company. It wasn't just interesting to buy this little, you know, portfolio of four trade shows and sit on it, right? They, like I, had bigger aspirations and we needed to make bigger to move the needle for them at a corporate level. So they encouraged my bold thinking and they had the finances to go after it. So we acquired a company called Capsule. We got in a joint venture with Complex on ComplexCon, which was super exciting. I launched a educational conference called Agenda Emerge, which is kind of like TED Talks for fashion entrepreneurialism and a media brand around that. So all of the above, right? You know, every single way they could, they were encouraging me to go bigger, faster, think internationally, and really push my ideas to the brink of that they could go.
What a great partnership, because sometimes, you know, joining a bigger corporate, they want to throttle you. Things are more controlled, more measured, but it seems like for the type of leader you are and your ambitions, it was like a great partnership that actually propelled you and gave you experience. I think that was really setting you up for your next phase, which is taking a digital business, which was Complex, which I know, you know, did start back in 2003 as a print magazine, but it became a huge digital business. And then your role was like, all right, how do we create an incredible like IRL event for it? So talk about how ComplexCon came to be. And I'm just curious, what was in that initial pitch? What were you thinking?
The interesting part about selling my company to Reed is that they own all of the Comic-Cons around the world.
Yeah.
They own 500 major events, many of which are consumer-facing, and they really focus them around passionate fan communities, what they call fandom, right? So it's like PAX for video games, New York Comic-Con, Star Wars Celebration, right? And I learned about this event format, which is really new to me because I was in B2B, and I said, I wonder if Agenda could become, and this is also part of the inspiration for some of them, like the Comic-Con for sneakerheads.
Yeah.
But I realized that Agenda had been building itself in the industry, but didn't have a consumer affinity. So I struggled to say, how can Agenda do what Comic-Con's doing? So this light bulb went on in a conversation I was having with another one of my mentors, which is Mark Echo, the founder of Complex Media. And we were at this event in LA, and I just said, well, why don't we get together and do ComplexCon, right? And yeah. I said it almost in jest. And he's like, yeah, I like that. I like that. And funny, standing there with him was Moksha Fitzgibbons, who's now the president at Network, and came over and Mark said, hey, you know, tell Moksha what you just told me. And I told them, they said, we like that. And they generally encouraged. And then a week later, I was in New York. I scrambled for a week. I put together this pitch deck and I got in a room with Rich Antonello, who is the CEO of Complex, and Noah, who was editor in chief, Mark and Moksha. And I pitched them this deck. You know, it was pretty basic. It just basically took the blueprint of Comic-Con and applied it to the brand of Complex. And they all loved it. You know, I was surprised, right? Because it was such a bold, ambitious idea. And we worked for 2 years from that point. That was January of 2015, I pitched them. We signed the contract in November of 15, and we launched in November of 16. You know, the funniest part about that conversation, which I'll tell you, which is everyone was around the table, very engaged. Moksha was sitting on the couch. at the very end of the presentation, I thought I'd done a great job. And he looks over from his BlackBerry and says, how much money are we going to make? And I go, like, profit? Like, you guys complex? I said, I don't know, $1 million. And he goes, do we really care about making $1 million? And I was so deflated at that point. I thought it wasn't going to happen because he was the chief revenue officer, right? Yeah. And I was like, well, if we don't get his buy-in, this thing's never gonna happen. But he actually got on board and was the biggest champion of the thing. And it was an amazing experience. But nothing more than say, hey, let's create the Comic-Con, the fan culture, Super Bowl, the World's Fair for sneaker and street culture.
And then thinking about the Agenda Show was a B2B trade show. This was like targeting consumers. Were you anxious about like, oh, wow, how am I going to drive the same type of like traffic and hype and momentum around this event? Or was it, no, I can do this. Like, I'll figure it out. I've done it before.
Well, I think that's exactly what I was saying is like, that's why I didn't just end up doing, call it AgendaCon, right? Complex had the consumer reach and the social media reach and the affinity with consumers. And I had the relationships with the brands and the exhibitors and the know-how and event production.
Yeah.
So the marriage was beautiful in that sense. It was kind of bringing my offline experience with their online marketing reach and bringing that.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we did a lot more things that neither of us would do, you know, marketed ourselves almost like a concert promoter, yeah, which is new to both of us. But it was the perfect marriage of their audience and our event expertise. And that's really why it worked.
Like you said, when you were at Reed, it was like your MBA, right? You're like a senior executive, a big public company, but you were just doing deals, launching new businesses and learning a lot about business as you went. This was probably a great chance to learn of how can you create an event from a digital business, but then really market it through all the paid and earned organic channels. And now thinking about where you are in your career, that was probably a great learning experience for you.
Absolutely, right? There's so many learnings in ComplexCon. And I think the number one learning for me was, as successful as the event was, the digital groundswell that the event created, the, call it organic customer acquisition, the earned media,
yeah,
that was so big that was such an eye-opening experience for me, how much the physical world could influence the digital community so much more effectively than just trying to market to people digitally, right? And that was really my big takeaway and a lot of the inspiration for wanting to leave and come join Network.
And I know at ComplexCon now, with like $100 ticket prices and incredible curations of products, there are attendees who will spend days waiting in line just so they can get like early access to the different like product vendors, right? Did you guys see like lines out the door in your first year of ComplexCon?
Yeah, there was thousands of kids lined up around the corner on both sides of the convention center. We had a literal, and I mean this in the most literal sense, a stampede of kids,
wow,
pushing past security, knocking down full-grown security guards, stanchions, police officers, people literally almost being trampled to death. It was actually, yeah, scary. You know, in the second year, we had people who were stowing away. Like you think people stow away on a ship.
Yeah.
We had kids who snuck in like days before and were like hiding in a broom closet so they could, yeah, get early access. Like the level of pandemonium around ComplexCon year one and two and three was just so insane. It was dangerous. There were actually people injured, and it, jeez, was also so amazing to see. I was almost trampled to death in, wow, a crowd for people fighting for Pharrell sneakers at the Adidas booth. It was pretty insane, like the level that people go to, but also I understand not only the passion and the fandom, but if you can buy a sneaker for, let's say, $120 and resell it for $5,000 the next day,
yeah,
then you might be running, you know, full speed as well.
Yeah. And I imagine like you seeing that, like probably like flipped a switch inside you being like, wow, look at this fan energy and the fandom. There's got to be different ways that we can build this to be even bigger and then harness it both in like online and real world environments. And I think that probably leads, I think in September 2017, you have a conversation with Jimmy Iovine that you're starting to think through the new Network business plan. So tell me about that moment.
Jimmy and his son, Jamie, who's my partner, had a previous business in LA called Meltdown, which was a classic comic book store. And out of this comic book store, they were doing a YouTube show that was kind of like, call it QVC meets Comic-Con. It actually started to get a little energy. And there was an article written in Forbes magazine saying it was an innovative idea. And they had put a little money into it and were trying to launch it as a business and had some false starts. But the idea was there. And I got introduced to Jimmy around this idea that he was working on, which was the Meltdown thing. And, you know, they said, you know, what are your thoughts on this, right? It was just kind of a loose introductory meeting to just talk about this Meltdown concept. And I saw it and I inherently understood it. And I thought it was a great concept, but I had a little bit of a broader vision around what I thought Network could be. You know, we ultimately changed the name of the company and changed the focus to not just be kind of like Comic-Con pop culture focus. It would be a broader youth culture, sneakers, streetwear, entertainment, gaming, right? And
yeah,
this idea of aggregating the most passionate fan audiences into a platform, procuring the most exclusive drops, and having the actual talent who created them presented to you on a daily basis, I thought there was huge merit around. And ultimately that night I went home and I wrote a business plan that ultimately ended up being verbatim what we're doing for Network for Meltdown. And I was still working at ReadPop at the time. I felt like over the course of the next few months, the conversations I had with Jimmy and with Paul Wachter, who's chairman of our board and runs the investment fund Main Street Advisors, who funded our seed round, I saw one thing clearly. Not only I think this was a great business idea, but I thought for me, I'd done a lot of things in my career, and I think ComplexCon was the pinnacle of my career, but I had the opportunity to come and jump on board and work with a group of people who had a bigger creative vision than I had. And while I was at Reed, I was like the crazy creative one in the room.
Yeah.
And like in the conversation with Jimmy and these guys, I was the one who was thinking small. They're the ones who had the big, crazy creative vision. And I liked that, where I was like putting me back on my back to like level up, right? So that was ultimately the biggest exciting part. I mean, they had just sold Beats for $3.5 billion or whatever that was. And they really are epitome of people who take passion around creative and brand and push it to that mainstream level. And I had done, you know, I'd had relative success, but not that level, right? And I wanted to be in the midst of that type of greatness and learn from that to take my career to the next level.
So this happens in September 2017, and then you raise a seed round. And when does that seed round close? And when do you start being like all in and focus on Network?
I quit ReadPop in February of 2018, and then worked on refining the business plan on Network for a few months. And then in May of 2018, raised the seed round, and then we launched in beta in October of 18. And you know, from May to October, built the team, built the kind of MVP product, right? And just kind of worked on like refining what the business was and what the brand was.
How much did you raise in the seed round?
15.
15 million?
Yeah.
So what type of team did you assemble around you? And I think this was different because you're building a digital product. You hadn't done that before, right?
Yeah, look, there's three things we do at Network that I have almost no experience with. Building technology, becoming a media company, and being a retail company in a way, right? So I've been adjacent to a lot of those things. I've been on the boards of some companies that have done some of those things, but I had never done it. So that's other part of it. Super exciting for me. So look, we had to hire a whole new team of people who I prided myself in the event industry. If you wanted to hire someone, I knew who all the best people were. You know, this was really easy for me. My Rolodex there was really strong. This was like, you know, going in uncharted territory. So I had to figure out what I was doing and try to find the right people. And I think it was a big challenge for me in a good way, and challenged me to spend my network, no pun intended, and go out and find new groups of people to talk to. And, you know, I never hire like usually recruiters or people like that. I always do it through referrals. So this was a process. This was a 24/7 process of trying to find new, amazing people who came from other great, amazing organizations.
Who or what was most helpful to you during that time? Was it your board? Was it Jimmy? As you were being like, okay, I need to have a new muscle to hire these new leaders with capabilities that are unfamiliar to me. What was helpful?
Yeah. I mean, look, everyone was helpful. Ultimately, just me pounding pavement, picking up the phone and trying to, you know, spend a lot of time on LinkedIn, right? Just cold hitting people up, right? And sometimes great people come to you in interesting ways. Like, you know, our CFO, COO, who's still here today, Emerson, came from a referral from Gaston, who was the original owner of Meltdown, the comic book store. And you wouldn't think the guy that owns the comic book store is going to find you your CFO, but he actually found us the best guy, right? And, you know, referral and just, you know, always going out there and telling everyone you know, whether it's your aunts, uncles, cousins, friends, colleagues, what you're looking for and asking who they know and getting people to send you great people is honestly the best way. And everyone was helpful, the board, the internal staff, and me just literally going on LinkedIn like a crazy person and finding people who look like they were impressive and just dropping them a cold line. And then I'd have to try to explain to them, hey, I want you to come to this company that doesn't exist, that I can't tell you a lot about yet, that doesn't have anyone else working here. Are you interested? You know, that's always a fun process. And getting people to leave their careers, it isn't exactly like I'm the founder of some, you know, billion-dollar tech unicorn and this is my second thing, right? Like there is some selling involved here.
But I think that you had an amazing career to date. You had a pretty rock star board and set of investors. So when most people heard your pitch, were they like, yeah, Aaron, this is exciting. I'm in. If you were to say like the biggest trepidation, like people who hesitated, what was the number one reason?
I would say every department but technology has been, I would say easy, but we could recruit people.
Okay.
Technology is by far the hardest thing because if you're an amazing engineer, if you're an amazing CTO, you're an amazing product person, there's nothing but options for you in this world.
Yeah.
And everyone has the same pitch. Amazing founders with an amazing backstory who've had success before, amazing board, and tons of money in the bank from some of the top VCs and private equity funds. So in that case, even though we had a lot of those things, we were in no better footing than anyone else. If anything, we were a step backwards. So I feel like that was the hardest thing and still is, right? I think we've come over that hump now. We finally recruited an amazing CTO here at Network, which is Marco, who previously led engineering at Goat for the last 6 years before joining us, which is obviously a very impressive business. But that's probably been the thing that took the longest amount of time.
I just interviewed Christian, the president of Complex, and he said that what's unique about his team is that everyone there is a fan. Either they like hip hop, they like streetwear culture, they like music. Was there also a through line that you were bringing from like, hey, as I've built my career today and for the team that I know that's really going to exceed here, people need to love this like intersection of pop culture and commerce and entertainment. Was that important to you?
It's always been important to me. I would say it's become, depending on the role, some places more important. We need the foremost experts, authorities, thought leaders, tastemakers in those fields, and people who are picking the merchandise, people who are, you know, having a consumer front-facing, you know, role in our business and has an effect on what you see on screen, right? And what our customers are consuming. But I also learned, you know, sometimes I would, in the past, I think this is an immature part of my leadership style, is that I would dismiss amazing people who could bring such value. They came from greatness, right? Some organizations have a culture of greatness and excellence, right? And I would dismiss those people because, you know, they weren't into what I was into, or because they didn't. I often in my career until Network, I think, overlooked some really amazing people that probably could have helped me along the way. So I think that can be a very arrogant thing to kind of like dismiss someone if, you know, they don't love sneakers, right? I don't even really love sneakers, to be perfectly honest with you, right? So, you know, I think it's both. You need a good mix of finding the best people who are the hardest workers and who are the smartest, who are going to challenge you and bring value to the business, and finding the people who are going to help you keep on the center of culture and blend those people together.
Before moving into some of the specific work that you're actually doing at Network and some of the partnerships and the launches, what did it feel like to go from a like hustler entrepreneur to now a steward of capital? Like you had raised $15 million in the seed round. It's a big seed. I believe all your other businesses were bootstraps. Like you weren't representing investors. So what was that shift like for you?
Everything I had done until Reed was completely independently financed by me.
Yeah.
And I treated those like real scrappy businesses, right?
Yeah.
And everything, I was fighting tooth or nail for everything down to, you know, what I was paying for an office chair, right? So like if someone tried to order a $50 office chair online, I'm like, you can get it for $30 at IKEA, right? Like those little things, right?
Yeah.
My cousin used to call it the $1 million loaf of bread. It's these little things that add up to all of a sudden you spent $1 million and you're regretting it, right? So I was really scrappy in my entrepreneurial days. At Reed, I was scrappy, but I definitely learned to be a shepherd of capital in that I was working in a publicly traded company and there's a lot of process there. So I think the two things really set me up well. I understood how to work with large amounts of money at Reed, and I understood how to be a scrappy entrepreneur in my whole previous career. And I think I applied both those things well here. And I went back to trying to be scrappy to the point where even sometimes the board would say, Aaron, you're being a little too scrappy, right? Like you got to spend some money, right? Like you got to lay out, we gave you all this money. You got to actually buy some Herman Miller chairs, right? Whatever that analogy is, right? It's not all about chairs, but I like to use that as the analogy for frivolous spending. Look, I feel every day utterly responsible for the investors who gave us money and the LPs for the funds that I need to deliver for them. And I put that pressure on myself every day to an extreme extent that I need to return, right? And like, oh, these VCs gave me money and like, whatever, it doesn't work out, 1 in 10, they'll get their money back. Like, I don't think about it like that, right? And I hope nobody does who's a CEO, but like, I feel an absolute personal obligation to deliver and to deliver minimum tenfold for everybody.
For the investors who will listen to this, I think they're going to be very happy to hear that sentiment. What also comes out here is that these new investors, like, you know, Jimmy and Warner Brothers Digital and LeBron, also want speed. Like for a return on capital, it's like, Aaron, yes, being prudent is great, but like just move fast. Like you're onto something and we're betting on you, and the market is, it's, you're going to help build this market. And so speed is a major asset. I think that starts to show its face, because then you raise pretty quickly after your seed. You then raise a $10 million Series A in September 2019. So that I think is led by Live Nation and Foot Locker, and Drake's also involved. So at this point, what are you now building towards? And what are kind of like some of the key build highlights that are now setting you up for what we're going to talk about, is where is Network going in the future?
What we're really building for is to build the definitive marketplace for youth culture amongst the coolest personalities and pop culture goods, the most sought after drops and releases across every category that we think is cool, right? And,
yeah.
And that's a pretty expansive view. And I think we're aggregating, you know, much like I did at Agenda or ComplexCon, right? We're finding these passionate audiences. We're convincing the most meaningful players in those audiences to create special site-specific drops and things for this platform. And now we're just doing that in a digital way and in a much more expansive amount of categories. And we got the proof of concept in 2018 and 19. And now it's just about how do we scale that? How do we get more people on the platform? How do we go from one drop a day to 40 drops a day is what our hope is by the end of next year. 40 unique, specific, custom, exclusive things in one day is a lot, right?
And to do over and over again, it's not like you're just building up towards one single day a few months out. It's like, this is a daily thing.
Yeah. And how do we make each one of those not only equal quality, how do we increase the quality over time? And how do we take this from a few million people to tens of millions of people, right? And we become the, you know, for the overused elevator pitch about our business, the QVC of Gen Z. Yeah. And I think that is exactly what we're trying to do. And I don't take objection to that elevator pitch. I actually like it.
So as you think about going from like one drop a day to 40 drops a day, is there data from the performance of your past drop campaigns of like, what is selling, what is driving user acquisition that you're using as a data feedback loop? And, or is it also a combination of just going gut of like, you know, this is a cool product, I dig it, we're going to launch with this too. What is that approach?
I would say it's 50% gut, 50% kind of data at this point. And I think over time, it'll become more data. In the beginning, it was probably 100% gut because we had no data. You know, obviously it's taking learnings from the things that are working, the categories, you know, the personalities, right? And there's a lot of learnings in there around how we scale this business. And there's also a lot of surprises, right? And I think some of the biggest surprises we learn is like, just because X celebrity has a big audience doesn't mean they can sell anything or anyone wants to buy anything from them. And there are many personalities that have a much smaller audience, maybe just a few hundred thousand, that can sell 10X any big celebrity because they have a hyper-engaged audience, an organic audience. And I think that's been one of the biggest surprises. And I think one of our biggest aha moments was like in 2018, you know, Ninja was the biggest esports star in the world, right? Like he's still a huge star, right? We're like, oh my God, if we could just get Ninja to come on network and like sell some stuff, yeah. You know, when he was like on the Ellen show and breaking the internet, like, you know, we'll get a million downloads in one day, yeah. Right? And, you know, we go, we do this deal with him, we get him on and he's got an exclusive collection for us for holiday and like 50 people came or something. Like Whoa. It was like nothing, right? Yeah. You know, like new people. It was like ridiculously low. And it was like, wow, it's like sometimes these people that are so big actually don't move culture in the way that you think they do, right? They're kind of propped up stars for like consumption and clickbait, but they're not really able to, you know, have a meaningful consumer products business. So sometimes you can't just go off of the data of how big their social audience is or what their engagement looks like online, you know, things like that. You have to have some gut around like, do people actually want to buy products from them? And I think there's a lot of examples of big celebrities who are very much household names, but couldn't sell anything. And then there's some people that can, you know, create a brand that does billions of dollars, right? So wow. I think it's, yeah. So it's a real hit or miss there. And that's really part gut, right? That almost becomes the more important part.
It's interesting hearing about that because at my company, Rockwater, we are helping different like shoppable entertainment companies think about what their go-to-market launch is. And so we've been reviewing like tens of these different like live streaming content products. And we're seeing that some of the platforms actually audit the different types of creators or influencers that are onboarding and saying, are you a good fit? Are you not a good fit? And if we think that you're going to be a premium creator, you'll get more customer service resources and we're going to help prop you up. Has your team built any proprietary tech or methods of how you assess the personalities that are going to do the product collaborations with your team?
I wouldn't say we're assessing them beforehand. We definitely have the post data when we work with them.
Yeah.
But you know, I would say here's the counterpoint to that even. I'll give another example. The most successful individual personality on our platform, besides Takashi Murakami, is a guy named Ben Baller, who's like a celebrity jeweler, podcaster, kind of all-around personality. He has a big consumer products business with us. He'd been on network for 6 months doing multiple things, and almost all of them didn't do very well in the beginning. And we kept sticking with him against the lack of positive data, right? It wasn't selling through. The audience wasn't engaging. And then eventually we had a breakthrough moment with him. I equate this almost like the agenda thing, right? Like you keep pushing forward. And we just had a feeling, or I had a feeling, this guy was going to work. And now he's our, you know, number two star on the whole platform from a revenue basis.
What was in your gut that kept you sticking with him similar to when you were at Agenda? Was it the ignorance is rich? Like, no, I just like, I believe in this guy. I like him. Or was there something else going on?
I believed in him. He was enthusiastic about the partnership, right? Like some people, like some celebrities, they do these things and like, it's like an obligation. Like, oh, I got to show up and do this thing, like, and sell this book or, you know, like they pretend like they're enthusiastic, but really like they're not. They do the bare minimum, right? They're like, oh, I'm obligated to do one social post. So I'm going to do just that. And then I'm going to take it down. Like there's those people that are going to fight to make their thing work, right? They're going and doing like Gary Vee, great example. Like that guy is a salesman of all salesmen, right? Yeah. Like he gets on and he's going to pitch himself like nobody. DJ Khaled, Ben Baller's one of them. Like, they're enthusiastic and they're going to go above and beyond tenfold. And I knew that eventually it would break through. And then it did. And there were even people inside our own org who tried to kill the partnership. Go, hey, this guy's not working. We've got all these other products on it, but let's put these on the shelf, right?
Yeah.
Let's not push forward. And I'm like, no, you got to do it, right? And it wasn't anything other than just seeing his level of enthusiasm towards the partnership. And I believe that, you know, you can bank on that.
The talent enthusiasm is so key because they have so many opportunities in front of them nowadays of how many different social platforms that they're on, how many different advertisers they can work with, what products can they launch. And I remember when I was running Big Frame, the management company under Awesomeness TV, you know, partners would come up to me and ask like, oh, how do I work with your talent? Or how is this going to be a thriving partnership? And I would always say, you got to sell them on your product and on your vision and not just throw money at them. And I would often next, I'm like, hey, if our sales team was pushing too hard of like, oh, this was a big 6 or 7 figure deal, but like our managers knew that the talent weren't really into it, I'm like, we shouldn't do this because this is just going to fail. And both sides are going to walk away unhappy. So I like how you describe like the enthusiasm is so key. Curious to talk about the future vision for Network and some of the things that you're building towards. I've heard you talk about that you want to festivalize marketing and user acquisition. And I think that there's definitely intent to have many more shopping festivals, I think, in the new year. Tell us a little bit more about what you're thinking there.
One thing that I was obsessed with from day one, even in the original business plan, was looking at things like Alibaba Singles Day, which obviously, you know, has become, since the last 3 years, a much more well-known thing here in the U.S. You know, they made $75 billion this year. I think they made it a week-long event. Previous iterations, it was a day-long event. They made $35 billion.
Yeah.
And they really took something that was like Black Friday or Cyber Monday here in the US, and they made it look like the MTV Music Awards. And it was a video-first event. It was live stream, and it was crazy, right? And how do they entertainmentize shopping, right? And I kind of took, how do you take something like a ComplexCon, something like an Alibaba Singles Day, and you know, make a marriage between those two ideas, and you kind of launch an online shopping festival. And that's really, you know, what we're doing with Network. And in the coming year, we're launching 6 proprietary shopping festivals, each one around a different audience vertical, and 2 big shopping holidays. And, you know, these are big ideas for us. We did our first one this year called Transfer in August, which was kind of a design and culture festival that in partnership with a creative named Edison Chen from Hong Kong, an artist named Futura 2000, which was an amazing event. And we had over 2 billion media impressions on that event.
Wow.
So we're excited about that. We're launching one in just a few weeks here called Beyond the Streets, which is an online art fair that's kind of themed around street art and graffiti, which previously was a physical event that now we brought online. And next year we'll have 6. We'll do one called Unboxed in February that's themed around kind of collectibles and toys. We'll do one in March or April, called Off Court, which is kind of focused on basketball culture. So, you know, really about packing 2 days full of content, meaning dozens or almost 50 to 70 exclusive drops in a 2-day period, bringing in the talent who created those drops or musicians, athletes, artists to do panel conversations, much like we would at some of my physical conventions or festivals in the past, having live music performances, having a gift shop, having physical takeaways we send to people in the mail beforehand, and really entertainmentizing and festivalizing this online shopping experience. And it's really about taking hundreds of pieces of content that you could usually absorb over the course of a month and smashing it into a 2-day period and creating sensory overload. And we're excited about what that does for the business on the go forward and how that draws new customers and how that creates excitement and also stimulates brands and creators to want to work with us, right? If you just call them and say, hey, you want to do something on a Wednesday because it's Wednesday, they're like, eh. You call them and say, you want to be a part of this festival? And like, you know, all the top brands and creators in the world will be there. You know, it's a much more motivating value proposition.
Are you building this online experience in tech in-house or are you working with a partner to do it?
It all lives on Network's native iOS and Android platform. So it's literally sitting right on top of our day in and day out platform. It's not a separate experience. And that's the whole point. Like the whole purpose of this is to draw people into what we do and to utilize the technology and the proprietary native commerce and video technology we build here.
You are planning 6 of those events in 2021?
6 festivals and 2 shopping days, which is kind of like a 1-day festival. So like, for example, 10-10 is Network's birthday.
Yeah.
So that's like, that's our annual celebration where we do a huge promotion. We don't want to be a retail company. I think that's a dead asset class. I think it's a boring idea. And I think the number one thing for us to do that is we're creating these moments. We'll do some of the standard retail things like Black Friday, Cyber Monday, back to school, whatever. But like, how do we create our own moments and we can create our own annualized trend? Like, what if we stacked all of our festivals in the first quarter, which is usually the lightest quarter for retail? Yeah. What if we could buck that trend by doing all this exciting stuff? So we're creating our own retail holidays and creating our own trajectory of what we do and when we do it. We don't want to prescribe to what Macy's does per se.
I was going to ask, like, how you gauge success of that? Is it, you know, ComplexCon, we'll talk about, hey, we drive 20 to 30 million of like merchandise sales in Long Beach, and we're like the number one contributor to that economy. Are the KPIs for you like it's revenue, but also how it fuels the rest of the business, our ability to attract like, you know, different artists and personalities to the platform for the new year?
It's all the above. It's obviously revenue is an important KPI. Transfer, for example, was our highest 2 days of revenue ever during our last festival. Obviously, we intend to beat that coming up in the new year. User acquisition, earned media. We got, like I said, 2 billion media impressions on that. It's also about, you know, how many new brands we attract to the platform, new talent, because then those people can have an ongoing relationship with us. Yeah. Even things like Google Trends data. If you look at the dates around transfer, some of our highest searches for network, right? So all of these things are extremely important KPIs or metrics we're going to track, but we want them all. And I think that's the great thing about a festival. It solves for every meaningful thing we'd want to track in the business. A festival just accelerates that.
So let's also talk about another big initiative for the company, which was your April 2020 investment in FaZe Clan, one of the world's largest like esports and gaming collectives. If I understand this right, it was a $40 million round for FaZe Clan, and you guys were the lead investor. Is that accurate?
Yes, absolutely.
So what's the strategy where Network is redefining shoppable entertainment and shopping at the speed of culture? And now you're also making a really big investment in esports and gaming company. What is the goal of that?
I think it's a pretty simple idea, which is we want to be at the forefront of what's happening in youth culture. I look at FaZe Clan as, you know, the leading brand in what is arguably the fastest growing space in media and entertainment, which is gaming, lifestyle, esports, right? The numbers are astronomical.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we think about attracting new audiences that are passionate about something, you know, to me, esports is the skateboarding of the day, right? This is the thing that captures the hearts and minds of possibly billions of people, right? Yeah. Not just, you know, millions. It's a much bigger total addressable audience here. And why not partner with the top brand and organization and the largest brand and organization in that space? The analogy I like to use is that Netflix brings disruption to video streaming, Spotify to audio streaming, Network is trying to do for merchandise streaming, right? This is a category that doesn't really exist. So what makes those platforms destinations is the proprietary content that they have. So not only did we make an investment in a great organization, but we also secured a deal to control the global consumer products rights for that company. So right now, if you go on Network and you scroll down through our feed, in a couple days from now, we're dropping an exclusive FaZe Clan Beats by Dre headphone exclusively on Network. So when you think about us bringing together a collaboration like that, first time Beats has ever been in the gaming space. Obviously, Jimmy, our lead investor, was the founder of Beats, bringing together with the top gaming organization in the world, and you can only buy that product on Network. Same analogy, like you can only watch Game of Thrones on HBO, or you can only watch House of Cards on, you know, Netflix, right? Proprietary content drives new audience and drives revenue and drives retention. So how do we as Network strike multiple exclusive deals with meaningful brands, creators, organizations that you can only buy their things on our platform? And that gives us product or content exclusivity, which is going to be, you know, the moat around the business as we grow. I think there's many platforms that have quote unquote shoppable video. I think we have better shoppable videos than others, but you know, you'll be able to buy stuff on any number of video or social platforms in the future. But if we have things that you cannot buy on Instagram or you cannot buy on YouTube, or you cannot buy in those places, then you have to come to Network. And that is the real meaningful value proposition and moat that we can offer in the future as video commerce becomes a commoditized proposition.
Are there plans to make other investments like what you did in FaZe Clan going forward?
I don't know if we'll make other investments. I think FaZe Clan is unique. But I think you'll see us making many exclusive distribution deals and signing creators per se. Like FaZe Clan is unique because they have an organization of dozens of creators, right? So that's like, you know, a larger one, but I think you'll see us making many deals with individual creators or individual brands, but not necessarily investments, probably exclusive licensing or exclusive distribution deals.
And as you think about where you want the Network experience to go, have heard you talk about, it's all about just delight the user, delight the consumer, make the shopping experience fun and sticky and that they want to return and that it's also a valuable form of expression, kind of like their identity. So what are other ways to build towards that where you're like, you know, we're not here yet, but in 3 years, like, I really want to have this be part of the experience?
It's a combination of multiple things. Right now, I think we've done a good job of getting amazing products.
Yeah.
I think we have an area to improve on, which is making the content as entertaining as the products are amazing.
Yeah.
And as you can start to create that marriage of true, you know, people start showing up to the platform just to be entertained. And then they also say they want to buy. I think that becomes 1 + 1 = 10. I think the festivals are really the first step in heading in that direction, where we're creating the term retailtainment. And we can be a true retailtainment company and be at the forefront of that movement. I think that that is probably one of the most important things in us continuing to invest. And maybe instead of doing 6 festivals, we're doing 10 or 20, because there's so many passionate audiences out there we can cater to. We did one this week for anime, Japanese anime, right? Which was a highly engaged media genre. But I think it's a combination of having amazing and proprietary products, having an amazing entertainment experience, and doing both of those things at scale and continuing to move into new verticals. Like in the future, we see beauty as a vertical that is just as engaged as, let's say, sneakers. I think there's endless amounts of creators and passionate fan communities that make sense for what we're doing. And we are just scratching the surface. And I think people probably look at our business from the outside in and think it's very male sneaker streetwear focused. And honestly, sneakers is less than 8% of our business right now. Things like toys and collectibles is by far our largest category. And I'm not sure if people would think about it that way. And that's all, you know, everything from a $500 bear brick to a $15 Funko toy by transaction volume and by revenue, by far our largest categories.
Interesting. Just a couple more questions before we get into rapid fire and close this out, Aaron. I liked what you said about redefining the content experience. And I was actually just interviewing Michael Gaston, who is the former founder and CEO of Cut.com. And now he's the head of studios at Stage 10, which is a live streaming platform. And they're also making moves into commerce as well with, I think, Rosie, which is maybe coming out within the next 6 months. What I've heard him talk about, but also other executives, is like, what are the owned and operated content formats that are really going to propel the live stream shopping and shoppable entertainment space forward? Because it's not just like, oh, well, what about the formats on YouTube, like the unboxings or what's inside? It's like, no, there's got to be new formats that are really unique to the new technology solutions that are coming out in the space. And these new formats can be seeded and incubated at all the different platforms, but that they can exist everywhere. And that's a win, because that'll push the whole industry forward. I don't know if that's part of maybe like your hiring plans, but thinking about like network as a content studio and having a real creative to run that. But I like where your head's at there.
Content has been at the front of our mind, and we've had various different content formats, and we continue to have them, some scrappy lo-fi digital content to some stuff that looks like a beautiful docu-series that we've done with Nike, right?
Yeah.
And I think we continue to experiment. We've had great people that continue to work who came from Vice and from Complex and, you know, some of the best digital content companies in the world, and we'll continue to hire more producers and creatives from those companies. I think in terms of formats, I was equally inspired by HQ Trivia. As a content format, a truly interactive, appointment-based, energetic, like Jeopardy for the mobile-first generation, right?
Yeah.
That has like a real tangible UI, UX experience that ties with the content. And I think you'll see us doing stuff in that vein in the future. And it, honestly, like when I wrote down in the very beginning, it was like, you know, QVC and HQ Trivia as a format on screen, right? And it's that vertical host and you're asking questions. So I think that's something we're thinking about a lot, as much as we're thinking about gleaming insights on content from traditional television. Like one of the number one things I want to launch on network over the course of the next year or so is a late night talk show format, which is like a Jay Leno, David Letterman style show. Meaning like, you know, what is that show to me? It's celebrities coming on when they have something to sell. They're there to sell a book, a movie, an album. They do the interview. It's engaging. And that's why the audience there. And then they hold it up and they say, go buy this book at Amazon. And they cut to commercial. Why do we not give you that meaningful interview experience and we sell you the book and we sell you the, you know, the toy from the movie, you know, the Robert Downey Jr. is there, we sell the Avengers toy, right? And I think, you know, we're looking at actually a lot of, you know, breakdowns of traditional linear formats that I think would be successful on a platform like ours where there's a real call to action to purchase.
And as you guys continue to invest in that and become like more and more a media company, the idea to also kind of syndicate, if this is part of your marketing strategy, like to syndicate your content and those experiences to other platforms. Like on, you know, I know you did a partnership with TikTok recently. And like, could you be syndicating to Facebook, to Instagram, to other emerging live stream shopping companies that is, you know, not only propping up the industry, but it's building brand awareness for you across a distributed network, but still driving the most activity towards the network app?
Yeah. You're about to see us launch a series of content, I believe this month, if not early next month, with Snapchat. So we've got a series of shows called The Art of the Drop that are releasing with Snapchat, doing exactly what you said, working with our stable of creators and exclusive products and releasing them on Snapchat. We see that as largely brand awareness, great ways to get in front of a new eyeballs and hopefully drive people back to our native platform. I think our sole focus, though, is driving people to our native platform because the trends change. It went from Facebook to Instagram to Vine for a second, back to Instagram to Snapchat to TikTok, right? It's an ever-evolving spin. And it's like, you don't really ever own your audience there, right? So us spending a lot of time, money, or energy in building an audience on any one of those platforms is not a high priority for us.
Got it.
Because we are our own platform. We have a direct relationship with our consumer and no one can make us pay to get past an algorithm to reach our people. So it's always going to be more valuable for us to build our proprietary audience than our proprietary platform.
Aaron, last question before we go into the rapid fire. Have heard you talk about your career in thirds. There is intent in your final third to want to give back in a very meaningful way. And so I'm curious, when you hear about, you know, Supreme selling to VF for $2 billion, what is the plan for Network? How would you describe success over the next 5 to 10 years for Network? That's not only a win for your investors, the users, and your team, but also for you to get into this next third of your career. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
I think that comment is largely driven by, I have no illusion that majority of what I've done in my career, while it's been satisfying personally or financially to a certain extent, I've ultimately done a lot of pointless stuff, which is help a bunch of teenagers buy cool t-shirts and sneakers in various forms. And you know, while I have an affinity for that, I think that I aspire to do something more meaningful with my life on this planet. So I think of, you know, what I'm doing with Network in this stage of my professional career as, you know, one, I'm still fairly young in the big scheme of things at 37. I got a lot of life left in front of me. I would like to, at a certain point, exit from this type of professional life and enter full-time doing philanthropy. But I also think that one thing I committed to when helping get Network off the ground was injecting a certain amount of philanthropy or philanthropic projects through this lens. And I thought, what a great way to raise money, opposed to just asking people for donations, like a GoFundMe model, selling extremely cool things for charity, right? You've seen companies like Red do a great job of that. We were really lucky earlier this year to work with Japanese artist Takashi Murakami on a charity project that we raised money for social justice and Black Lives Matter related causes. And we gave $1.4 million away to charity through the result of that project we did with him, which is a huge actual donation amount. A lot of people raise money, but you know, sometimes the actual donation amount ends up being smaller after all the costs and things like that. So, you know, our goal and aspiration is to raise millions of dollars per year through Network, working with all these cool brands and creators, making products that are specifically designed to raise funds for meaningful causes, whether those are environmental causes, various number of things that are important to us here. And I think this is a great platform to do it. When you think about what you used to see is like the Jerry Lewis telethon, you see these video formats, call us now, you know, as a phone bank of celebrities. Like, what a great platform. We can take your credit card, sell you something cool. And we also are doing direct donation buttons inside the app now. So I think there's a lot you'll see almost like telethon-esque things coming to Network. And I think that that at least makes me feel like a bridge between what I ultimately want to do and what we do now for a job.
You're reinventing the fundraising model and you're setting up your next third concurrently. Aaron, let's get into the rapid fire. All right, so this is around 6 questions, really short answers. Couple words or couple sentences max. You ready for it?
Yep.
Proudest life moment.
I don't know, my life moment, proudest professional moment would be the launch of the Agenda Emerge conference.
What do you want to do less of in 2021?
Stare at my phone for endless hours a day. And the screen time app is not helping me do that as effectively as I'd like.
I hear that answer quite often. What do you want to do more of in 2021?
Spend more meaningful time with people that I care about, friends and family, not looking at my phone.
What one thing drives your success, in your opinion?
Insatiable appetite for being competitive and winning.
Advice for media and commerce execs going into 2021.
Don't do boring shit.
I like it. I mean, that's the experience of Network. It's like, have fun with it. Make something cool. Last two here. Any future specific startup ambitions?
Always. I have a book with about 20 ideas in it.
Okay.
You know, we'll never have the time to do, but I have multiple on the list.
To be clear, always more to come from Aaron Levant. All right, last one. This is an easy one. How can people get in touch with you?
I am not really on social media. I don't really have a public-facing profile, but they're more than welcome to email info@thenetwork.com and someone will forward it to me.
Got it. Aaron, this has been a delight and a really fun conversation. Your story is just such a wild adventure. So thanks for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me.
What another fun interview. So after having done a handful of these, what's just so interesting about Aaron is that he was just a hustler and a fan since very early days and didn't have the traditional academic grooming to be an executive or anything like that. No formal professional training programs. He just tried things at an early age, like that car magazine, and then just followed his love for streetwear culture, pop culture, music, and just started building things. And yeah, he tells a great tale. And it was really fun to dig in, better understand how Network came to be, dating back just like, I think a little over a couple of years ago. Those early conversations with Jimmy Iovine and then having to recruit executives that had different expertise than he had worked with before. And then just what he's working towards in the future. You know, the festivalization, the 6 shopping festivals coming up in 2021, trying to have Alibaba Singles Day meet ComplexCon, and thinking about the new content formats that they're working on and syndicating that to Snap and Twitter, just some really cool stuff. And it was fun to hear about how he wants to give back in his final career third. That was awesome. And I think that he's going to likely participate in our upcoming live stream media and commerce conference. So more to come on that from us. If you're interested in getting involved or want to learn more about it, maybe want to speak at it, you can reach out to us at tcupod@wearerockwater.com. All right, all. That's it. Thanks for listening. The Come Up is written and hosted by me, Chris Irwin, and is a production of Rockwater Industries. Please rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe wherever you listen to our show. And if you really dig us, feel free to forward the Come Up to a friend. You can sign up for our company newsletter at wearerockwater.com/newsletter. And you could follow us on Twitter at TCUPod. The Come Up is engineered by Daniel Turek. Music is by Devin Bryant. Logo and branding is by Kevin Zazali. And special thanks to Andrew Cohen and Mike Booth from the Rockwater team.